From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Rather than saying that what they're doing is justified, it says that they're in the wrong town, in the wrong country, executing the wrong policy. If anyone could be the enemy, then you have no justification for being there.
We go to Iraq to get reports from two independent journalists. And we speak to retired Air Force Colonel Sam Gardner about the U.S. military strategy in Iraq. Palestinian activist Farouk Abdelmouti has been released after nearly 2 years in U.S. immigration detention. And as the deadline to file taxes nears, we'll take a look at how the covert campaign to rig our tax system to benefit the super rich and cheat everybody else.
We have two systems going on here. One for ordinary Americans. The government takes the money out of your check. It knows what you make. You can't cheat. And another for very wealthy people who are connected who don't want to pay taxes.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East, General John Abizaid, asked Monday for two new combat brigades, or up to 10,000 more U.S. troops, to help fight the growing resistance in Iraq. There are currently 135,000 American troops in Iraq. While announcing the need for more troops, Abizaid said the Iraqi security forces had been a great disappointment. There have been reports of U.S.-trained Iraq troops refusing to fight against the Iraqi resistance and other troops who quit the army to join the resistance. Up to 3,000 U.S. soldiers are now massed outside the Shiites' holiest city in Iraq, Najaf, where the Shiite cleric Muqtada Sadr has been holed up. On Monday, Sadr pulled back his militia from controlling government buildings in Najaf, Karbala, and Kufa. On Tuesday, a U.S. commander said, quote, "My intent is to destroy Sadr's militia, absolutely destroy it, and then to capture or kill Sadr. That's our mission. We're just waiting to be unleashed." A U.S. attack on the holy city of Najaf could inflame anti-U.S. sentiment among the Shiite community. The Iranian newspaper Baztab is reporting that the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani has warned the occupying forces not to attack the Shiite holy cities of Najaf and Karbala. Sistani, who is the most influential Shiite in Iraq, said if such an attack occurred, the religious leadership of the Shiites would fight to the last breath. In Baghdad earlier today, U.S. troops arrested a representative of Sadr in a central Baghdad hotel. In Fallujah, fighting has decreased but continues. Earlier today, the Associated Press reported a U.S. Apache helicopter crashed outside Fallujah. Witnesses said it was hit by a rocket from the ground. There was no immediate word on casualties. U.S. officials Monday claimed they'd fought a clean war in Fallujah, despite reports the majority of the 600 Iraqis killed were women, children, and the elderly. At a news conference Monday, an Iraqi reporter asked the U.S. military about the images of children being killed in Fallujah that were broadcast on Al Jazeera. General Kimmett didn't deny the charge, but said, quote, "Change the channel to a legitimate, authoritative, honest news station." Meanwhile, Monday saw a spike in kidnappings and disappearances. Among the missing were two U.S. soldiers and six U.S. employees of Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root. Another KBR hostage was taken over the weekend. Three Czech journalists are also reported missing. Three Russians and five Ukrainians were taken hostage yesterday. They were released earlier today. The three Japanese civilians taken last week remain hostage. The Los Angeles Times reports Halliburton subsidiary has suspended some convoys delivering supplies to troops because of safety concerns, raising the risk that troops could suffer from a lack of food and water. On the campaign front, Senator John Kerry criticized President Bush's plan to hand over power in Iraq on June 30th because it remains unclear just who would take power. Kerry also said he would replace Paul Bremer, the American overseeing the occupation, with a special UN envoy in an attempt to de-Americanize the occupation. The Los Angeles Times reports the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, John Negroponte, has emerged as the top candidate to become the American envoy to Iraq. During the 1980s, he served as ambassador to Honduras during the height of the Iran-Contra affair. The New York Times is reporting the Justice Department made efforts Monday to persuade the 9/11 Commission to rewrite a new report that portrays Attorney General John Ashcroft as being uninterested in counterterrorism issues in the months before the September 11th attacks. FBI's former counterterrorism chief, Dell Watson, reportedly told the commission that he fell off his chair when he learned Ashcroft had failed to list combating terrorism as one of the department's priorities in a March 2001 department-wide memo. Ashcroft is scheduled to testify before the commission this afternoon. The 9/11 Commission is also expected to issue a report criticizing the FBI for missing a series of clues that suggested al-Qaeda's preparing an attack within U.S. borders. Tonight, President Bush is scheduled to hold his first primetime press conference since just before the Iraq invasion. It's only the third primetime press conference of his administration and just his 12th news conference overall. Palestinians are warning the Bush administration that it would be torpedoing the peace process if it allowed Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to keep control of settlements in the West Bank. Sharon is expected to meet with National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice in Washington today and with Bush on Wednesday. And New York-based Palestinian activist Farouk Abdelmouti has been released from jail nearly 2 years after he was detained by U.S. immigration officials. We'll have more on this later in the program. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The new intifada in Iraq has wrested control from the occupying U.S. forces and thrown the country into chaos. U.S. soldiers are coming under daily attack throughout Iraq. The number killed since the beginning of the invasion has jumped to 665. The number of Iraqis killed this month alone is much higher. The streets are not safe for anyone as soldiers, military contractors, journalists, aid workers are at risk of being attacked or kidnapped. Today, we get a report from two independent journalists in Iraq. We begin with Aaron Glantz of Free Speech Radio News.
Speaking from his ranch in Crawford, Texas, the President of the United States, George W. Bush, told reporters, American soldiers have acted against, quote, lawlessness and gangs in Iraq over the past week. The American theater commander in Fallujah told Britain's Guardian newspaper 95% of those killed in the assault on the city are armed militants. But that's not the story coming from Fallujah's temporary emergency clinics. This Baghdad doctor has spent most of the last week in Fallujah. His name is being withheld for his own safety.
When you see a child 5 years old with no head, what you can say? Or you can, when you see a child with no brain, just opened cavity, what you can say? Or when you see a mother just hold her child, still an infant, with no head. And the shells all over her body.
So many Fallujans have been killed by the U.S. Marines that residents have resorted to digging mass graves. The city's football stadium now holds more than 200 dead bodies.
We buried many in the stadium football until it's now full. Before I came, it's full. But the problem where, how you are burying, you cannot stand in the football stadium for a long time because they will shoot on you. So we use a shovel just to make a hole, a big hole, and we just put the cadavers from one family, one over the other, and just cover them with sand and just went out from the place as soon as possible.
The official number killed in Fallujah is 600, but the total number of civilian casualties is likely much higher. The official tally only reflects those deaths reported by the city's mosques and clinics. But American snipers and bombers have killed many people while they are inside their homes. Businessman Hamza al-Hamza comes from a prominent Fallujan family. He says two of his cousins were killed and five injured when an American warplane bombed their house. He says after 2 days, his family members still lay dead in the living room.
2 days. Put ice from the refrigerant over them. 2 days. Spent 2 days, and he will look for in the garden. Maybe he will put them in the garden now. Because they don't have a place. If you are going outside, maybe he will kill everybody. Going outside of his house, the military of the army of America, maybe they kill him. You know, you are leave with the two guides was killed.
The doctor says his ambulance was attacked multiple times as it sought to bring aid to residents stranded in their homes. Once when it was trying to retrieve dead bodies for burial, and a second time when it was attempting to bring food aid to homes cut off by American snipers.
I seeing people carrying white flag and yelling for us, trying to say that we are here, just try to save us, but we cannot save them. Because whenever we open the ambulance, they will shoot us. We're trying to carry them food or water by containers. As soon as we put the container on the street to push to them, the snipers hit the container of food. The ambulance until now with bullets in the front window. Whenever you can go to Fallujah, you can see it. The driver with me just shooting. I left the family with no food, with no water, until now.
Businessman Hamza al-Hamza says George Bush has made an enemy of every Iraqi person.
No work for everybody. No electricity. No water, clean water. Now, many people came from Fallujah. They said to me, there are many pumping from the airplane, from helicopter, from the army. Is that war with the people or with the al-Mujahideen?
In Fallujah, the city is in full revolt. As residents gather inside a neighborhood mosque, fighters gather outside ready to fight the U.S. Marines. One is only 11 years old. In nearby Abu Ghraib, Amar Abu Zaid and his family of 58 have taken shelter in a relative's house. The family had gathered together in Fallujah from all over Iraq for a wedding before the bombing began.
Hey, binti, ma khad abna khoya. Then, ma qadna ani isme.
This is my daughter who was getting married to my nephew. We had to celebrate that. We called it a challenge wedding celebration. There was another wedding celebration that was broadcast by Al Jazeera during the time of the bombing. Last night, after the wedding, when we got out of Fallujah on the road back, one of our women was pregnant and she started to give birth, so we couldn't take her to a hospital. She gave birth in the car. A son was born, and we named him Mujahad, or Holy Warrior. And I asked God that he will be a Mujahad.
For Democracy Now!, I'm Aaron Glantz in Baghdad, Iraq.
And this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting on more than 200 radio and television stations around the country. I'm Amy Goodman. As the situation in Iraq is increasingly dire, at least 60 U.S. troops have been killed over the past week, the highest number of the war, including the week of the invasion. Many more have been wounded. There are no reliable estimates of the number of Iraqi dead. At least 800 have been reported killed in the last week alone. The actual number may well be much higher. The top U.S. commander in the Middle East, General John Abizaid, is asking for the equivalent of two more combat brigades, as many as 10,000 troops, to keep U.S. forces in Iraq at around 135,000. Reports coming out of Fallujah indicate a massacre of some 600 Iraqis, including many women and children, at the hands of U.S. troops. Meanwhile, 3,000 U.S. troops are massing around Najaf, and U.S. military commanders are talking about invading the city and capturing or killing Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Kidnappings are now rampant throughout the country. 9 Americans, including 2 soldiers, are being held hostage in Iraq, and 6 employees of Halliburton are missing. 3 Russians and 5 Ukrainians who were taken hostage yesterday were released earlier today. The 3 Japanese hostages have not been released. Danish NGOs are leaving. It seems likely most civilian aid workers will also now leave, setting back reconstruction immeasurably. Meanwhile, at a news conference with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, President Bush responded to reporters' questions on the situation in Iraq.
The situation in Iraq has improved, but you're right, it was a tough week because of there was lawlessness and gangs that were trying to take the law in their own hands. These were people that were trying to make a statement prior to the transfer of sovereignty that they would get to decide the fate of Iraq through violence. A civil society, a peaceful society, can't grow with people who are willing to kill in order to stop progress. And our job is to provide security for the Iraqi people so that a transition can take place. And that's what you were seeing. And our job also is to protect American lives. If our soldiers are at risk, they will defend themselves. And I'm proud of the fact that our soldiers did so, mindful that there are innocent Iraqis, oftentimes in between them and an enemy that is shooting at them. We're a compassionate country that cares about the loss of innocent life, and it grieves us when we see innocent life lost. However, we will defend ourselves. I strongly believe that by far the vast majority of Iraqis want there to be a peaceful country and a free country, and so the Iraq people are on the side of the transition to a peaceful country. We just can't let a few people, and I say a few, listen, there was enough to cause harm, but a few relative to the rest of the peoples. We just can't let, you know, a small percentage of the Iraqi people decide the fate of everybody, and that's what you're seeing.
President Bush addressing reporters yesterday in Crawford, Texas. When we come back from our break, we'll talk to another independent reporter in Iraq, Rahul Mahajan. He's author of Full Spectrum Dominance. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. He's running a new blog called EmpireNotes.org, one of the only journalists in Fallujah during the U.S. siege of the town. We caught up with him late yesterday in Baghdad after he'd come out of Fallujah. This is Rahul Mahajan.
We were in Fallujah over part of Saturday and Sunday morning before we left, and I can tell you from whatever I've seen, there's a big controversy now with the Arab press, Al Jazeera in particular, reporting U.S. atrocities and war crimes in Fallujah, and the U.S. press tamely reporting Brigadier General Mark Kimmett's claims that no such thing is happening. And I can tell you from what I've seen with my own eyes that Al Jazeera is much closer to the truth. Al Jazeera is saying that about half the 600 people killed at least were women and children, and of course the larger number were in total were non-combatants. I saw with my own eyes many women and children who were injured and at least one who was quite certain to die. They have been reporting shooting at ambulances by snipers. Right now, with the quote ceasefire in effect, the primary mode of attack for the United States is not the heavy bombs that they were using in the earlier stages, but snipers on rooftops. And I can tell you, I saw two ambulances. One of them had two neat bullet holes on a downward trajectory right in front of the driver's side of the ambulance. They would scored probably direct hits on the heart of the ambulance driver. Another ambulance, again, with the one single very neat bullet hole. There was no way this was an accident. These were deliberate shots into the windshield of the ambulance to kill people sitting in the front seat. Given the circumstances in Fallujah at the time with completely blacked out streets and ambulances with bright lights flaring and sirens going, I can't imagine that the snipers could have mistaken them for something else.
Rahul, you're one of the few Western reporters who've gotten into Fallujah. How are you operating there?
Well, it's a very tricky situation. There was one British reporter, Lee Gordon, who had a number of Iraqi contacts, including a man who was a nephew of a local sheikh and had was on good terms with many people and could negotiate passage through the Mujahideen. So we had to first use American and British white faces to get us through the American roadblocks, and then we had to use these connections to get us in there. I'm quite certain that we would be in very dire straits if we didn't have people who knew very well the local resistance in Fallujah. While we were there, it was mostly a relief operation. We took in medical supplies and we evacuated some wounded back to Baghdad. So it was very difficult to do reporting. There was a lot of tension, and people at the hospital we were at were working feverishly to save a few lives with very inadequate supplies. But I did get to see a few things.
In your blog at empirenotes.org, you quote Time magazine. In some neighborhoods, the Marines say anyone they spot in the streets is considered a bad guy, says Marine Major Larry Kafish. It's hard to differentiate between people who are insurgents or civilians. You just have to go with your gut feeling. Your response?
Well, it's absolutely true. It is true that some of the young men in Fallujah have not picked up their Kalashnikovs yet, but the resistance, the Mujahideen, they are the people of the town. They're referred to as Shabab, which simply means youth, just the way that the stone-throwing boys, first Palestinian Intifada, were. It is true that anyone who doesn't have a gun today could pick up a gun tomorrow. That says to me not that they are justified in killing any military-age male or making sure that they remain there in besieged Fallujah, which is their policy. They're not letting military-age men out in general. They made an exception for us. We brought some wounded out. But it says to me that rather than saying that what they're doing is justified, it says that they're in the wrong town, in the wrong country, executing the wrong policy. If anyone could be the enemy, then you have no justification for being there. It is, in fact, the exact logic they used in large areas of Vietnam. In any of the free fire zones, for example, again, military-aged males, if they were moving at all, they were targets and they could be shot at indiscriminately.
We're talking to Rahul Mahajan. He is author of the book Full Spectrum Dominance, is in Iraq right now, keeping a blog, empirenotes.org. He's just come out of Fallujah, is in Baghdad right now. You have been in Iraq a number of times. How does the sentiment of the population compare now to what it has been?
Well, I was here in January, and I interviewed people extensively. And in Baghdad, which is the only area I was in then, I could sense an incredibly widespread anger, atmosphere of deep frustration. I mean, literally 90-plus percent of people in Baghdad would tell you things are worse now than they were under Saddam Hussein. It was especially striking that doctors and hospitals told us they got less in the way of medical supplies then than they did under Saddam. But that anger and resentment hadn't yet crystallized. The resistance in most areas was relatively marginalized. It is true that in Fallujah it had a lot stronger rapport and of Ramadi and the rest of Al-Anbar province. The Shia had not decided to move to violence. They were very much biding their time. And now all of that has just explosively changed in the space of 10 days. At the same time, the entire, whatever little legitimacy the occupation had, and it was very, very little, has completely collapsed. A number of people in the governing council have resigned. The rest of them are very silent. They oppose the brutality of the American policy in Fallujah, and they're also now terrified of being killed by Sunni Mujahideen or by al-Sadr's brigades. If they say anything, the United States has completely lost control, and even the mildest of people are now absolutely enraged at what is being done in Fallujah and want the United States out.
Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the commander of the U.S. ground forces in Iraq, told reporters in the United States in a video link from Baghdad, "The mission of U.S. forces is to kill or capture Muqtada al-Sadr." What is your response, Rahul?
Well, I mean, this just shows the complete lack of any kind of political thinking or political strategy to this whole thing. The first axiom in any kind of dealing with a movement like this is when you want to look at a leader, you have to think about his followers. Capturing or killing Muqtada al-Sadr is just going to make the Jaish-e-Mehdi, the Mahdi army of his, explode. It is going to instantly get every other Shia cleric so that they cannot possibly do anything but condemn the U.S. action. Sistani is going to have to come out more in force. And a number of Shia who are holding back now because they don't really follow Sadr have told me, they said, if Sistani gives the call for war, then we'll pick up our guns. It is the most idiotic thing they could think of doing.
What do you think of the comparisons of al-Sadr to Saddam Hussein?
Al-Sadr is an extremist. There are many people, you know, obviously he's going to make sure that that women who don't wear their headscarves are abused in public and so on, and it's not going to be very pretty. I don't know if he can be as abusive and repressive as Saddam Hussein. I don't know if he can be as repressive as the U.S. occupation, but he's not a good alternative. He's just the kind of alternative that it was inevitable to arise in a country where the United States went in and just deliberately created this impossible situation, taking away a government and putting in nothing with even a shred of legitimacy in its place.
What about the U.S. government saying that it is calm now in Fallujah, that there is a ceasefire?
Well, they were saying that when I was there, and there was no ceasefire. I mean, I think what they did was they spent a few days without dropping the 500-pound bombs, which is what they were using, 500-pound bombs on residential areas. It's a terrifying thing. They were not using those when I was there, so they called ceasefire. But as I said, the snipers were sniping everywhere. We had a constant stream of wounded into the hospitals. This tiny little makeshift clinic had a dozen people come in, and it would have been far more if there weren't entire sections of the town cut off by the snipers and incapable of getting someone from one place to the clinic without being killed. So I think the claim of a ceasefire was a joke, and I see no reason to believe it now either.
Rahul, what about the presence of mercenaries, of the growing private army outside of the U.S. Army?
Well, I think that this is part of a standard trend of just making sure that the limited controls that are at least legally in place on actual U.S. government employees, like congressional oversight, can be gotten around. There are claims that many of these mercenaries don't get proper training and so on, although it's not at all clear to me what kind of training the ordinary soldiers get. I think it's just really, it's part and parcel of the whole problem. It's the corruption, the corporate cronyism in contracts, the use of private armies and private mercenaries. It all goes to show just what a disaster this whole occupation is. But I don't think their conduct in particular is so vastly different from that of the ordinary military. I think it's just an extension of the same problem.
How long do you plan to stay in Iraq, Rahul Mahajan?
Well, I had planned to stay until April 25th, but the situation has deteriorated rapidly. Foreigners are being kidnapped at an alarming rate, and humanitarian NGOs, even some like the Italian Bridges to Baghdad, have been doing excellent work here for a very long time, are pulling out. Bridges to Baghdad is leaving tomorrow, if I understand correctly, and other groups are thinking about leaving as soon as possible. So anything could happen, and I just am trying to figure out from day to day whether it makes sense to stay here. Already most of us are captive in our hotels because, you can't find translators who will take you around most of the time. They're afraid of being the targets of violence.
Can you tell me, Rahul, how you function each day when you go outside of the hotel? What do you do? How do you protect yourself?
Well, frankly, I don't do anything to protect myself. I have the slight advantage that I look very much like many Iraqis. There are a lot of them are darker skinned and indistinguishable from an Indian, which is my origin. So if I play deaf and dumb, I'm not particularly a target. Others, women, you won't find a single foreign white woman in Iraq who doesn't wear a headscarf whenever she leaves. You'll see Iraqi women without headscarves, but you'll never see an American woman without one. I've heard that even some of the more delicate featured men with very striking, like blonde hair do the same thing. But in general, there's nothing you can do to protect yourself. Everybody's got a Kalashnikov, and, it's just a matter of luck. I just try to keep my head down.
Would you say that there is tremendous fear among the Iraqis?
There was fear. There was a great deal of fear, but I actually see Iraqis losing their fear and seeing it transmuted into anger. The same people who would have said, you know, al-Sadr's people are thugs, well, some of them still say it, but now they say, in a sense, there are thugs and they're protecting us against the brutal occupiers. The people, as I said, of Fallujah say of the Mujahideen, there are boys, there are people, and we support them. So I don't think that Iraqi people feel. I think that they do feel that there will be consequences. I mean, there are women in Baghdad who go around with uncovered heads who know that in Fallujah, if they do that, they're very likely to be the subject of violence, but they still support the Mujahideen because there's so much against a brutal occupation. So I see much less fear, much more anger.
And have you gotten a chance to talk to U.S. soldiers?
Initially I did when I was in Sadr City a couple days after the outbreak of violence there, and I talked to some young men who were posted there. They'd only been in Iraq 3 weeks, and so they were more friendly and easier to approach. There was one we tried to talk to who simply kind of waved us on the way that most troops will do if they've been in the country for a long time. They get extremely wary and nervous. But these guys talked to us. They were perfectly nice. They were very, very ignorant of what was going on in Iraq. They were there in Sadr City because of clashes with al-Sadr's Mahdi army. And I asked them, so what do you think about this stuff with al-Sadr? What do you think about the Mahdi army? And they said, what? Who's that? Who are they? In fact, one of them was very curious and came up and asked us several questions trying to figure out who these people were. They were thrown in here. They don't know any Arabic. They don't even know how to say, please get away from the tank in a respectful way. And they're sent over here to kill people and die. And it is a shame. I haven't been able to talk to any in more recent days.
Rahul Mahajan, speaking from Iraq, author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. He is just out of Fallujah. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we bring you this national broadcast exclusive. Palestinian activist Farouk Abdelmouti is out of jail after almost 2 years. He was never charged with a crime. A prominent Palestinian activist in the New York area has just returned to New York. We welcome him to Democracy Now!'s airwaves. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Farouk Abdelmouti.
Thank you very much, sister and comrade Amy Goodman, and thank you for Democracy Now! And all of yours to support me, because I feel myself part of yours, you know that, and this struggle, what is today, continue for the constitution of rights and for the rights of the people in the nation and overseas is a linkage one to the other ones. And we have to admire people like you, what is continue in the struggle for our rights. Yes, I win my freedom yesterday, 3:30. I was in a box in a place, it's called him United States Penitentiary, what is a big penitentiary located 15 minutes from the airport of Atlanta, Georgia. And after he moved me from there to the office of the INS, and INS tell me you have to go to Reagan Airport with Delta, and after you have your freedom, and give me some papers to sign it. I think the paper is from the Israeli embassy to sign about my papers, because according to him, she say, you know, if it's possible, you can be, Israel is going to accept, by decide to accept Palestinians. And after put me in the airport, to the airplane, and I moved from there to Reagan Airport in Washington, and after from there, I come in U.S. Airlines, and I arrive in the LaGuardia Airport 10 o'clock. What my friends and my family and the people support me and, you know, support my freedom. What I think my freedom and my rights is some supposed to be part of the examples in a struggle for justice and equality and rights in the society of United States, what is built up for all different communities and all different ethnics to create a new society with democracy and rights.
Farouk Abdelmouti, for those people who don't know your story, quite a remarkable one. Again, you were detained on April 26, 2002, almost 2 full years in jail. Can you go back in time and talk about what happened? Talk about even going back to the raid on your apartment when you were on Pacifica Station WBAI's airwaves with us on Wake Up Call.
Yes, really, when I was in the WBAI on Pacific Pacific Station and Wake Up Call in the morning, is coming the task force and. Was in the beginning of the month of April to looking for me, and I not was there, coming to the house and harass my son and harass the person live there, Bernie McFall, and after that ask for me. My son called me and Bernie called me to the WBI, and after we talked to everybody in the radio what can happen. After in 26th of the month, he's coming back. And break the deal, because already my lawyer speak with him, so I meet him 2 weeks after. And we call him after 2 weeks. My lawyer call him in that time. And after that, what happened, the officer say, well, it's not the moment. We're going to tell you what day we can meet together. And by surprise, on 26th of April in the morning, about 4 o'clock in the morning, three task force with the lot of police in blue uniforms coming 18 ones to the door and try to break the door. And after I ask my lawyer and tell him, he tell me to open the door. When I open the door, he's jumping over me and take my work permit. And he say, you are under arrest because your documents is not illegal. You are illegal. And after he send me down the stair and try to investigate me and talk about if it's possible you cooperate with us and we can help you to let out. And after I reject all these things, you know, I tell him, you know, I am 56 years old, you know, and I not coming to be participator or a snitcher about myself or the society in general. And after they stuck me to the Federal Plaza, there in the Federal Plaza, the people left, and after some of them attacked me, and after 15 minutes after the lawyer came and see me in my condition, and moved me for to Middlesex County Jail in New Jersey. But when I stayed there for several months in that place, it was a very difficult place because it was deportation by wholesale. People from Pakistan and Afghanistan, majority are Egyptians, be deported day by day by the aeroplanes. Got families, some of them I think got even citizens in this country. And is moved me from there, and it was a protest outside. The jail is not accept the protest and coming to harass me and harass another people with me. And after this condition gave me to, I be moved from there to the other place is called him Camden County Jail. In Camden County Jail, I stayed there for 1 month and beginning to have problem with some of the guardians because some of the guardians come to the inmate, Pakistani inmate, and take his Holy Quran and throw him to the floor. And after that, I tell him, you know, you're not supposed to do these things. And after the people, majority of the inmates come together and reject that kind of action, and the warden take directions to call the INS to move me from there, and after I end in Passaic County Jail,
I'm gonna stop you there just for 60 seconds because we have to go to break. We're talking to Farouk Abdelmouti. No, not in detention as he's been for the last 2 years. He is a free man right now as he talks about his trials in detention, not to be confused with a trial where he was found guilty or innocent. He has never been convicted of a crime, and now he is free as he talks about moving from the Camden County Jail to the Passaic Jail and what happened within. We're going to come back with Farouk Abdelmouti and this exclusive broadcast, his first broadcast since he has been released, flown last night from Atlanta to New York. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Farouk Abdelmouti, the Palestinian activist who has been jailed for almost 2 years, taken on April 26, 2002, 2 weeks before, as he was broadcasting on Pacifica Station WBAI in New York with us on Wake Up Call. His apartment was raided in Queens by federal authorities. Several weeks later, they captured him. He was imprisoned, and yet no charges were brought against him. In jail for almost 2 years, and then released, a judge ordering his release last Thursday night. They moved him from the jails in the New York area to Atlanta and now flew him back from Atlanta as a free man to New York. Farouk Abdelmouti stays with us on the telephone. Again, welcome, welcome to Democracy Now, Farouk. You were describing moving from Camden to Passaic, a Pakistani man, his Quran being taken from him. You explaining to the guards the problem with this and then them moving you, you say, as a result of your intervention?
Yes, the result of my intervention, and the warden is half bad reputation in the state of Pennsylvania, and people riot him. I think the Afro-American Muslim is riot the place, and he lose the job, and after he's coming to be the warden in this private county, call him Camden Jail. And after when he see my record, he prefer to call to INS and move me from there to INS come there to move me, and he take me to the other place. What you can tell is the rat's place, because it's called him Passaic County Jail. It's the place very dirty, the place the leak by the water from the roof, the situation, the food was terrible, and the condition is inhumanist against all the inmates, and specifically the detainees was the INS suffering a lot in that place. And after that, the people beginning to raise his voices, and people sign, and I sign with these people from more than the 46 nationalities, and more than 78 people sign to send it to the human rights organizations to talk about the situation of this jail in Passaic County Jail. And after happened these things, me and other people from Middle East, we make a hunger strike for 8 days in condition I need my release. And the other ones need the rights to move from there because got children. To somebody from Lebanon is named Saleh, have a daughter, just have 3 months, and he's going to be deported, and he like to see his daughter. The other person from Egypt have a daughter, is 1 year and a half. And we make a hunger strike, somebody from Mali, other person from Afghanistan, and one Lebanese, one Egyptian, and myself, and somebody from Sudan. The Sudanese can continue the hunger strike because got ulcers. And after that, the INS intervene in the question, and move after 8 days, is get promised to move, and second week is moving to Hudson County Jail, and me, I stay in that place, put me in separated place, you know, it's not solidarity confinement, but a big place what I be by myself.
We're talking to Farouk Abdelmouti. He is just out of prison, just flew in late last night in jail for almost 2 years. We are asking you to stay with us, Farouk. Your attorney, Jeff Fogel, is on the line with us, and I want to continue to talk to you, Farouk, about your experience. Legal director, CCR, we talked to you yesterday, Jeff, as Farouk describes his experience. How unusual is this, as he describes the people in jail with him almost 2 years without charge?
Well, first, let me welcome Farouk. I haven't had the opportunity to see him since he's been released, and he sounds much better than the last time I spoke to him.
Thank you, my brother Sharif, and thank you, my sister Amy Goldman, and all of you for Democracy Now.
I think Farouk was targeted ab initio from the start due to his activism in the community. I think, secondly, it is not unusual for people who raise simple constitutional rights within the setting either of a pretrial detention, an immigration detention, or even a criminal conviction to be targeted by prison authorities as well. As I think I indicated yesterday, there are a considerable number of people, upwards of 200, in jail as a result of immigration charges, convicted of nothing, who've been held for extended periods of time. How badly they've been treated in comparison to what happened to Farouk, who was the subject of considerable abuse, harassment, and so on, I can't say because I'm not so familiar with their cases. But I think Farouk's is a particular one given his targeting as a result of his activism.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, Brother Sharif and Sister Amy Goldman, all of you on Democracy Now! And everybody listen to my voice. Really, after this situation, the INS came to me. I was thinking it's going to deal to give me some my rights, you know, and he's moved me from there 4 hours and a half to a place called him York County Jail, located in York and some of the areas of the Pennsylvania state. And I be moved there. When I moved there, I stayed for 1 day, lock up, and the second day put me with the population, about 2 days in the population, and the third day he say, oh, you have to move, and he's moved me in the solitary confinement. And I stay in solitary confinement in New York County Jail for every day 23 hours and 15 minutes. And just 45 minutes to take a shower, call, collect call phone, and to clean my cell. The cell is a box, iron box, with the you can see anything. You know, you cross, you know, the food. They give it, bring you from down like a, like we are dogs. You know, there in this place. I suffer in there 8 months and 10 days, which I catch from there arthritis. I catch from there gastritis, thyroid.
You know, I want to interrupt Farouk for 1 minute. You said you were for 8 months at the York Jail in 23-hour-a-day lockdown?
Yes, 23 hours and 15 minutes lockdown every day. Just.
And what was the rationale that they gave for locking you down? Again, no charges brought against you.
Yes, there's no, never given the reason, and I never never given to the reason at this moment. Never open it after that, you know. And the when we are fighting, we're fighting about my freedom and my rights. And the situation is still never give the answer why he's put me in 8 months and 10 days in this condition, you know. And after in this moment, coming the month March, the month of March, what is the situation? When the administration of Bush is talk about the war in Middle East and all these things, and many of these guards take in a stronger anti-Arab position there in that jail, and it's coming to be target me to just to come in to beat me up, you know, but I don't give him any opportunity to happen.
You were subjected to a lot of interrogation. What were they asking you?
Well, before one is asked me when I be arrested, is to cooperate with him, you know, to give information about the Palestinians and Muslim organization and all these things, you know, what is completely is away from my side, because I am a man, an activist for peace and justice and democracy. And I condemn terrorism. You know, some you are witness, and Democratic now is witness when it happened there in 9/11. I work very hard to bring the rabbis and the church and the imam. You know, I include them invite the imam Ahmad Dwidar to march in the front of the first protest. What is more than 20,000 people. You know, and I oppose any kind of terrorism, because myself, we are victim of terrorism in our country, and I oppose any kind of this kind of terrorism. I believe in the social and collective equality and justice for everybody with a democratic principle.
Farouk Abdelmouti is our guest, not in detention, but as a free man. He was released by immigration authorities last night after almost 2 years in prison. They wanted to deport you. Why couldn't they? Farouk Abdelmouti, a Palestinian activist.
Well, for many questions, you know, Jordan is can accept me, and the Palestinian authority at this moment is not developed to be accept people. Only it can give him documents to be accepted after the agreement of Oslo to the Palestinian live in the Gaza Strip and West Bank. But I immigrate before this accord. You know that, and after that, the situation is never, and Israel is not to accept me. And the only solution is to give my rights to my freedom, and we opened the habeas corpus, Zabdias against Davis, What is the right? You can stay more than 6 months in the jail, and I stay about 2 years to win my freedom.
Jeff Fogel, what about this issue of statelessness?
Well, the question of the statelessness to this moment, the last decisions, thanks to my lawyer Shane and Jeffrey from the Center of Constitutional Rights, was played very good and talently.
Let me ask Jeff Fogel about this issue of statelessness.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the issue here in terms of repatriation is the fact that Israel does not want any additional Palestinians moving into the occupied territories. And so they have been adamant in basically refusing to cooperate, even with the United States, their close ally, in repatriating people. So that, in a sense, leaves Farouk in a stateless position, particularly since he left the occupied territories before they were occupied, and so does not appear on any of what is called the Israeli registry of Palestinians living in the occupied territory as of 67. They claim to have no record of him, notwithstanding his valid Jordanian birth certificate. But the bottom line is, Israel doesn't want more Palestinians around.
Exactly. This is correct, like Brother Sharif has mentioned it, and this was happened, you know that. And after that, I win my freedom, but in the same time, the government sent a letter to Israel is going to be accept Palestinians. But after the judge, what is in my case, given 10 days to I be free, and if it's not have any solutions, one of the two, or you have to give him the freedom, you know that. And when the government never answer in 10 days, it's given the right to I win my freedom. Yes, and you know, like I mentioned before, back to my condition in that jails, you know, after I stay 8 months and 10 days in solitary confinement, is moved me to New Jersey to a jail belong to, it's called him Bergen County Jail, and in that place...
Farouk, we only have 10 seconds.
Yes, yes.
Your feelings right now.
Yes. Well, about my feeling, really, I still pain, you know, pain physical and at the same time spiritual, because it's not easy. You pay 2 years for no any reason, for no any crimes in jail and railroad, you and 8 different prisons, counties, jails, and penitentiaries, you know, and my hope, my inspiration when I speak with yours, give me power to continue this struggle for right and justice.
Well, Farouk Abdelmouti, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Welcome outside on this side of the bars. And I just want to let people know, as we launch our Exception to the Rulers media and book tour celebrating WBAI tonight in New York at Cooper Union, Farouk Abdelmouti will be our special guest. And
I hope
everyone can come out. You can call us for reservations at 212-431-9090. It is quickly filling up. We are starting a 70-city tour tomorrow night. We will be in Fresno celebrating KFC on Thursday night in Berkeley, California, celebrating KPFA, and we'll go on from there. Check our website, democracynow.org. Again, Farouk Abdelmouti will join actor Tim Robbins and Bernard White, Juan Gonzalez, Jeremy Scahill, David Goodman, and many others, the whole Democracy Now! Staff at Cooper Union tonight. Democracy Now! Produced by Sharif Abdelkoudis, Mike Burke, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.